Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After the mass shooting at a historical Charleston, South Carolina church in June, President Obama called for stricter gun controls and almost in the same breath suggested that the current Congress likely would not act. Even the shooting deaths of 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in 2012 did not inspire a change of heart in Congress. And some polls have shown that Americans, by and large, are more interested in gun rights than limits. U.S. News and World Report News editor Joseph Williams last week wrote about the progress on both sides. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi, good morning. Glad to be here.
From most vantage points, the pro-gun lobby appears to be winning, for lack of a better word. But you wrote that advocates of gun control are still optimistic. How so?
Well, what I learned in reporting that story is that the advocates for gun control are taking a longer view. And in their opinion, what is happening is a slow but steady shift that will take some years to finally come to fruition. But that shift is towards gun control reform. And basically, they base that on the fact that ever since Sandy Hook in 2012, they say there's been a turning point. They've gotten more money, more contributions. There are a lot more grassroots organizations out there that are collecting information, signatures, campaign petitions to reverse the flood of guns that are happening in the United States. They also point to the fact that the Brady Bill, the signature gun control law that we've had in the last half decade here in the United States, took not only 6 votes to pass in Congress, but James Brady was seriously wounded in the assassination attempt on President Reagan in 1981, and the Brady Bill wasn't signed into law until President Clinton took office in 1993. So they're saying that the long view is the best view and that from their vantage point, things are progressing and progressing a lot faster than they did in the 80s.
That long view back between 1981 and 1993 occurred during a much different kind of Congress, though, right? I mean, we're talking about a long, long view with the Congress that is installed now?
Yes. They're saying that, yes, you are, in fact, absolutely correct, that there were a lot more moderate Republicans who are willing to go along with it. But even then, it took a long time. But now they say the gun advocacy rights organizations are saying that you have a Congress that's deeply conservative, but the campaign contributions that they're getting for gun control bills are coming from a broad spectrum, and that even conservatives in the grassroots are in favor of sensible gun control legislation. Keep in mind the Toomey Manchin bill. This is the one that came out about 6 months after Sandy Hook. That one came to the floor in relatively rapid-fire succession, and it failed by just a relative handful of votes. And that was in a Senate where the Democrats were in the majority, but Republicans had very much obtained real power in enabling to veto and block legislation from coming to the floor. So they're saying that the glass, from their perspective, is half full, and that it can only get more full as time goes on, given the trends that they're seeing compared to the trends that we have in the past.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about where gun control and gun rights legislation and attitudes stand at this point in time in the United States. My guest right now, Joseph Williams, he's a news editor with U.S. News and World Report. We'll have a link to his recent article about gun control. It's called A Tipping Point on Guns. After a series of setbacks, advocates of gun control say they are making progress. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you're going to assert a point of view on the issue of gun control, please tell our screener whether you're for more gun control or you oppose more gun control so we can make sure we have balance in our calls. In Ohio, Governor Kasich just signed into law the state's biennial budget, a gigantic bill, obviously, but it included a provision that closed a media access loophole on concealed carry license holder information. A lot of pro-gun legislation is just crossing the T's and dotting the I's at this point in Ohio. Is that the case in other pro-gun states like Ohio?
Pretty much so. The most radical that we've seen in a long time, pro-gun laws are taking place in the heartland, mostly in places like Kansas, Texas, red states, where you have not only a restriction on allowing who gets to see concealed carry permits, you're also getting laws that say you don't even need a permit. In Kansas, Governor Brownback just signed a bill that the gun lobby is calling constitutional carry. And what that basically means is being allowed to carry a weapon anywhere at all times without even so much as training or a permit. And you can carry that weapon openly, you can carry it concealed, you can carry it any way you want. And in Congress, John Cornyn from Texas has introduced legislation that would allow gun laws and gun permits to be treated as though they are driver's licenses. In other words, if you're driving in Texas and you're carrying a license from Arkansas, that license is just as good in Texas as it was back home. So the gun lobby is getting increasingly aggressive in pushing for wider bills. On their website, they're trumpeting that as many as a half dozen more states are ready to sign on to this constitutional carry legislation, and that they've got ballot initiatives in several other states that they're looking forward to success with.
You know, the title of your article, "A Tipping Point on Guns," is there any sense that the pro-gun lobby is reaching the point, reaching a tipping point, that they're over, no pun intended, overshooting?
Well, yeah, there really is, because you've got a country where there are 88 guns for every person, and they're, one wonders what their ultimate goal is to have a gun in every pot or a gun in every three pots. And you reach a saturation point. I'm kind of reminded, even though this is a very indirect analogy, of the cell phone industry back in the late 90s, early 2000s, where they had reached a point that everybody had a cell phone, basically, and they were looking for new ways to get their product onto the market. And that's when you come up with cell phones with cameras, you come up with cell phones that can do other things besides just talk to someone. And the gun lobby is kind of pushing that, and they're expanding the boundaries and trying to reach a saturation point where everybody, every state has a law. But you also have a tipping point in the fact that there are some conservative states that are pushing back against this too, that are saying enough is enough. The gun control lobby will indicate that they've had success in Texas. And also, you can look at West Virginia, where the governor there, who succeeded Joe Manchin, who was a known Second Amendment right advocate, and who also, by the way, sponsored the legislation after Sandy Hook, he rejected the constitutional carry because he saw it as a threat to law enforcement. And it wasn't necessarily on liberal grounds, on the fact that people are getting injured by guns every day and the fact that it's a health problem. He is saying that this endangers society, this endangers law enforcement, therefore we can't have that. Now, it's an open question as to whether or not his political ambitions will stay in West Virginia, mm-hmm. or whether they'll extend to the new Congress, but he got very much support from the public, and his move was hailed as something that flies in the face of conventional wisdom, and that also the gun control lobby counts down as a tipping point.
You referred to sensible gun control legislation. What falls into that category?
That basically encompasses background checks, making sure that people who own guns or who try to buy guns can't do so without a background check on the internet, without a background check at gun shows. Those are the two biggest loopholes and the two biggest things that the gun control advocates and Democrats and some moderate Republicans say are the most sensible pieces of legislation. One would also consider an assault weapons ban to be fairly sensible because, let's be honest, I mean, what are assault weapons for in the hands of civilians, except for shooting other civilians, presumably, or, as the gun control lobby likes to say, you know, defending freedom, whatever that might mean. But those assault weapons bans have pretty much gone down without much of a fight, mainly because statistics are showing that they're rarely used in homicides, in the day-to-day homicides. The other items on the list include bans against people who have convictions of domestic violence, of child abuse, and basically lower-level crimes, lower-level domestic crimes that a lot of people don't necessarily fold into the category of broader gun control. Because usually when we talk about gun control, it's after a mass shooting, it's after a terrible homicide like in South Carolina or in Sandy Hook, when the public has its attention and is focused on mass shootings.
Talk about the influence of the NRA on Congress. Is it just about money? They're getting pro-gun candidates elected, right? So they're starting at a local level. They're promoting them now to Congress. We now have a Congress that is very supportive of gun rights. But is it just about money at this point?
In a word, yes. But the longer answer, the longer explanation is it's about constituencies. Mm-hmm. And that's why you see the gun control lobby or the NRA lobby working very hard at the state level to try to get local ordinances passed, to get local laws passed, because it's a grassroots kind of thing. They've transitioned almost from Congress, because they've got it fairly unlocked, to grassroots and people at the local level to try to get them involved, get them to shout loudly to members of Congress. So that shouting also is part of the influence as well, because you've got, everybody knows that the NRA has got lots of money to spread around, and they do quite effectively. But what puts even more pressure on representatives is the voice of their constituents. If you come from a red state, you are not going to be against gun. You're not going to be against gun ownership. You're not going to be against. You're not going to be for any kind of gun control, because that's not what your constituents want to hear. And further, if you do that, you increase the likelihood of getting a primary challenge from your right. So in other words, people will say you're not conservative enough, and you'll end up with a primary challenge, and you stand a very good chance of losing what could be an incumbent seat or a very promising challenge to take an open seat.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how gun rights or gun control play a role in the 2016 presidential election cycle. It usually doesn't, because on the right side, on the Republican side, they usually tend to be pro-gun rights, and on the Democratic side, maybe sometimes more of a mixed bag. It's just not brought up that much. But Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders comes from a pro-gun Vermont, but otherwise runs very far to the left. So what sort of foothold does this give Hillary Clinton on the issue?
It puts her in kind of a tricky position. She's tacking to the left during the primaries. So in that position, she is very much for gun control, but you'll hear her talk about sensible gun laws, the ones we talked about, background checks, gun show loopholes, online sales loopholes. And you won't hear her talk so much about an outright ban. You'll also hear her say things like reasonable people can talk about this without people assuming that the government is coming for your weapons, because that's simply not true. So her position at the moment is to try to get people to understand that this is not an all or nothing issue, and that gun control reform is coming in increments, not in a sweeping kind of succession. And it's also coming from people who very much believe, she'll say it as well in a heartbeat, that she believes in the Second Amendment. So she's not talking about a ban on weapons, and her biggest task is to try to get everybody to hear it, not just the left.
How big of a deal is it out there that, say, even the media puts them at an elevated level, and a lot of people don't like that in the first place, but even the media don't have access to concealed carry license holder information in the state of Ohio now. There's hundreds of thousands of people have these licenses. Nobody knows who they are. Is that just the next step to just eliminating the license process at all?
It can be considered a next step, but generally at this point, they're probably just taking what they can get. From what I understand, Ohio is a fairly moderate state as far as gun laws are concerned, as gun control is concerned. They're not Texas, so they're not going to go for a full blanket, carry a gun whenever you want and buy one from a vending machine kind of stance. They're more likely to take this incrementally. But it is a very important issue that you raise, because we need to know as a community, we need to know who carries weapons, why they're carrying them, and if there is a reasonable need. Because the NRA's position has long been that you need good guys with a gun to take care of bad guys with a gun. But you can't be sure that every good guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. I'm reminded of Abu Nadal in the Fort Hood shooting. He was an Army officer, a decorated Army officer who had served, and he seemed like a good guy with a gun, and no gun owner, I would imagine, would hesitate to sell him a weapon. But he did quite a bit of harm with that weapon. And we know that you can't always count on people to represent their positive intentions and to be the ones you want armed in a free society to protect the general public.
And then one last question, Joe Williams. What about federal funding for research into gun rights and guns as a public health threat? A couple years ago, or some years ago, the funding was completely eliminated. President Obama says he as president can reestablish that funding stream, but there's been nothing put into it.
That's probably because there have been a few other priorities, but I think that's something that the president definitely needs to do, because as it stands right now, our gun research into gun deaths and our big picture of how guns are affecting the public health is very mixed. We don't have a lot of good, consistent information from state to state. We don't have a lot of research that could refute some of the talking points that both sides are making, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have enough information as a society to make a valuable, important, longstanding decision that would allow us to take this seriously and allow us to have a reasonable debate. It looks as though he may get some traction on this issue, depending on what happens, because in Congress there is some talk that the Toomey Manchin bill may be revived, and Harry Reid has talked also about counting noses to figure out if he's got enough votes to succeed in this area. So I would look for it to happen, not right away, but certainly if Congress gets a foothold in this issue, it may come to pass.
Well, Joseph Williams, thanks again for talking to us today. I appreciate your time.
Very much. My pleasure.
Joseph Williams, he's news editor with U.S. News and World Report, and we'll have a link to his recent article, A Tipping Point on Guns, on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. All Sides with Dan Fischel will return on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The gun control debate continues, with those in favor of gun control saying that fewer firearms lead to fewer shootings, while those favoring gun rights say the opposite. Joining us by phone is Jim Irvine. He's chairman of the Buckeye Firearms Association. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Good morning, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here.
And in the studio with us is Jennifer Thorne. She's executive director of the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thank you.
Jennifer, your organization and others characterize gun violence as a critical public health issue. Why is that?
Well, in Ohio and in 17 other states in the District of Columbia, guns actually kill more people than automobiles. So I would say by definition, that's a public health issue. You know, we are losing so many lives and so much potential, and those lives lost every single day.
Jim Irvine, we'll talk more about studies in a few minutes, but right now they're certainly correlative. They don't show a causation between guns out there and people dying from gun violence. But what about that public health characterization of it?
Well, we mix things up. We've got to separate accidents from intentional acts if you want sensible data and understand what you're looking at. What Jennifer is citing, over half of firearm deaths are suicides. So, I mean, people also commit suicide by hanging themselves or poisoning themselves. No one thinks we have a rope violence problem. That's just a silly statement. The same thing holds true whether you kill yourself by hanging yourself or with a gun. It's a suicide problem. It's a mental health problem that we have. It's not a gun problem.
But they say that if a gun's in a house and somebody's suicidal, they're more likely to achieve their goal of suicide versus pills or a rope or something like that.
Men are more likely to use a firearm than women.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of data around suicides and stuff. But the bottom line is, you can look at our country, look at other countries where they don't have guns. They still have huge suicide problems. Someone who is intent, we've got a law that makes it illegal to commit suicide. Someone who's intent to commit suicide, who really is serious and wants to get it done, they're going to get it done. I mean, that's the sad reality of it. I'm sure all of our lives have been touched by a suicide. There's nothing good that comes out of that. I wish we had a better way of dealing with it, but I think we should be focusing on the suicide issue, not whether it's a gun or a rope or a pill or a jumping off a bridge. The suicide and the mental health is the issue.
And I suppose, Jennifer Thorne, the same could be said for a lot of gun violence. It has to do with mental health issues. It has to do with other stressors that the gun, and they say the gun doesn't shoot people, people shoot people. What about that? Are we putting too much is there not enough emphasis on mental health issues related to gun violence?
So, you know, first of all, I'll just note that if you're going to use a gun in suicide, you're going to be 90% effective. That means that you're going to have a much smaller chance of actually getting treatment and surviving. So that's just kind of one thing I would note about guns when it comes to suicide. You know, I do think that we need to focus on mental health issues and making sure that, you know, we're keeping our databases up to date when we do have background checks to make sure that, you know, folks that are in danger of hurting themselves or others are not able to get their hands on a gun. Certainly, it's one of many problems that we deal with in our society is mental health. And, you know, everyone that has a gun is going to be a good guy with a gun until they're not. And, you know, as we've just been talking about, we all go through different stresses in our life. We go through different crises. And if you have access to a gun, you're going to be more likely when you go through those kinds of stresses to, you know, end up hurting yourself or someone else.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about guns in American society. My guests, Jennifer Thorne, she's executive director of the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence, and by phone, Jim Irvine, he's chairman of the Buckeye Firearms Association. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to assert an opinion about gun control in Ohio, tell the screener whether you're opposed to gun control or whether you support gun control. Again, the 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jim Irvine, I just spoke with the author of a U.S. News and World Report article, Joseph Williams. The title of his article was A Tipping Point on Guns. Is there a tipping point for the Buckeye Firearms Association? Can there be too many guns out there?
No, I don't know that there can be too many guns any more than there can be too many cars or too many coins or whatever else somebody wants to collect. There can be too many of the wrong people carrying guns. There can be too much violence. There can be too much murder, rape, and mayhem. It's interesting. I just skimmed his article, and the one comment in big, bold print that they want to make the big point on is there hasn't been this much momentum behind the reforms that we seek, which is around background checks in decades. And I think that's a really interesting comment, given in March we had some new laws go into effect in Ohio, and one of them was fixing some problems with our background checks. This is something that we at Buckeye Firearms have worked on for probably 6 years. And prior to that, Ohio issued licenses to people who were under disability, people who were not even allowed under federal law to possess a gun. We would issue them a concealed handgun license. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody who thought that was a good idea, but that's because it was so screwed up in the initial law, because it was written by people who didn't understand guns or how any of this stuff ties together. And it was frustrating to me that we didn't have Jennifer Thorne or people from her or people from the other side. Everyone should have agreed to fix that problem. But we were fought to improve our background checks and get to a system that actually functions that we thankfully have today.
Jennifer Thorne?
So, you know, with the new an improved, as Jim would say, background check system in Ohio. The problem is that now when there actually is a background check, they're not having to check the additional state databases where a lot of information about individuals who shouldn't have firearms are actually stored. And, you know, we're still missing about 40% of guns that are sold. 40% of guns that are sold in Ohio and across the country are sold without a background check through the so-called private sale loophole. So that could be at a gun show or a sale that's initiated online through a classified. And that's really what, you know, we're looking for with Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence is a universal background check system where every time the gun is sold, you know, there is a comprehensive background check.
What do you consider comprehensive? What?
So, you know, we need to obviously be checking with, you know, the federal system, but also making sure that the state systems and the local systems are all kind of looped together so that we are getting up-to-date information about people that are at risk, maybe for hurting themselves or other individuals.
Where does that information come from? How do you know if someone's at risk or not? A lot of people, they're just being privately treated or not treated at all. There is no record.
Well, and that's something that, you know, we need to do a better job of. There needs to be a system in place where, you know, community members can report people. You know, if you're a physician and you have someone that is at danger of hurting themselves, you know, there should be a mechanism where you can report that to law enforcement, and then someone can actually make a decision. You know, a judge or someone can make a decision about whether or not that individual should at least temporarily, you know, not have access to guns until they can be stabilized.
Jim Irvine, could you respond to that? And also, I'm interested in your thoughts about waiting periods for guns, because a lot that's been put forth a lot as one way to stem spontaneous violence. I'm mad, I'm angry, I'm whatever, and I'm going to go get a gun and I'm going to hurt somebody.
Well, let me do the waiting periods first. That was easy. They're a bad idea. They've been used in other states. There's now plenty of studies on them, and it hasn't been shown to reduce the violence or the spur, I'm going to go buy a gun and kill someone, at all. It has been shown to be associated with the death of multiple people, predominantly women who testified against an abuser. He's getting out of prison tomorrow. They get the phone call. They go to buy the gun to protect themselves because that's what police said they should do. And they got to wait 7 days. They don't live that long because the guy comes and kills her before that's up. So there's not tons of data on it, but what it is says waiting periods are a bad idea. They don't work. Back to Jennifer's comment, something her and I wholeheartedly agree on is the databases and the issues surrounding mental health. It's a complicated mess, and I don't think either one of us is really happy with where it's at. I don't have an ideal solution for it because it's incredibly expensive to build a database. Ohio, to get a concealed handgun license now, you have to pass the same background check that you do to go into a gun store and buy a gun. It's similar to what is called the federal NICS system. It hits the FBI data stuff. It checks to see, under federal and state law, are you under prohibition from possessing a gun? If you are in any of those places, you can't buy the gun. Where we're missing stuff is in the mental health database. And that's in large part because it doesn't get reported. And there's reporting problems on how it does. There's problems with HIPAA and inability to report it. There's just so much around it. One of the problems with mental health is it's such a big field. So if you have someone who has anorexia, that's a mental health disorder. So there's people, if you have any mental health treatment, then you should be able to buy a gun, ever. Well, I think somebody who had anorexia when they were a teenager and now they're an adult and they're functioning well and they want to be able to protect their kids, I think that person should be able to go get it. I don't think there's any reason to ban them. But there's other mental health things where Jennifer and I can agree, hey, this person shouldn't be possessing a gun. The question becomes, how do you create a good mechanism that honors people's privacy, that doesn't prohibit the wrong people from possessing a gun or defending their life, but goes after the really problem ones that we agree we don't want them possessing a gun? And I just haven't seen a good solution on how to do that.
Do you agree? I mean, it is complicated. It's where do you draw the line? Who decides?
I agree it is a complicated issue and that we should have qualified individuals making those decisions. You know, maybe it's not everyone with any mental health issue, but there should be, you know, a qualified adjudicator making those decisions instead of having them, you know, almost being completely left out of our background check system.
Tracy in Garfield Heights, you're on the air. Hi, Tracy. You oppose gun controls?
I think sometimes that we have, as legislators, we legislate way too much. I was a council person for 13 years in Garfield Heights. Mm-hmm. And simply on any topic we could discuss, our city basically over-legislated on it. In regard to gun control, I do agree that there needs to be some sort of gun control because there's people walking around in my community who should not have guns. I hate to say this, but I agree with Jennifer in the fact that there's certain people with mental health issues that should not have guns. But then we have to invoke what happens then with our HIPAA laws. And with our HIPAA laws, they are in place to protect the patient. So then do we step on the rights of the patient to allow them to carry a weapon. It's
well, okay. So you're saying you oppose gun control?
Yes. I think that as legislators should not decide the issue of gun control because it's
who should decide? Who should decide then?
I don't know. I believe that perhaps there should be an equal call of pros and cons, people who are for it and people who are against it. Perhaps they should sit down and talk about it. People have had issues in regard to criminal acts should not have a gun. Whether that criminal act should be, would be.
You mean a criminal, someone who's a former, I mean, someone who's been convicted, a criminal?
Yes. Okay. And it doesn't have to be a felony. It could be a misdemeanor. Because I think if the threat of three strikes and you're out falls into that, and maybe some of these criminals wouldn't purchase a gun at a gun show. Okay. And in regard to going to a gun show and purchasing a weapon, perhaps we need to have somebody there walking around, even walking around with a pegboard, looking as if they are trying to ask these people if they have any mental health issues, who their doctors are. That might deter them enough without us as legislators and people who have the right to not, you know, to at least have that person think, hey, you know what? I did have that little episode with my manic depression, my bipolar, that lady's walking around. Maybe I shouldn't buy a gun right here.
Okay. All right, Tracy. Jim Irvine, what do you think about that?
I think the legislature has to set the rules. I mean, they set the rules for our society, and this is just one of the many places they do. But I think it's like we've seen in Ohio, this is a continuing evolution of things. We do something, we see how it works, and then we fix things we don't like, and, you know, continual adjustment and improvement of our laws. That's why it's called the Ohio Revised Code. It's being revised on a continual basis.
Okay. Well, we will continue our conversation about gun control in Ohio and across the country. My guests are Jim Irvine. He's chairman of the Buckeye Firearms Association. With me in the studio is Jennifer Thorne. She's executive director of the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence. Again, we'll hear from callers as well. Make sure you tell the screener if you're opposed or supportive of gun control in Ohio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the trajectories of gun control and gun rights laws in the United States, and specifically Ohio. Last week, Governor Kasich signed into law the new two-year state budget, which included a provision, a restriction that closed the last vestige of public access to records of Ohioans with concealed carry permits. This week, we're talking about how gun laws in the wake of the latest gun violence in a church in South Carolina have emerged. Still with us by phone is Jim Irvine. He's chairman of the Buckeye Firearms Association. And in the studio, Jennifer Thorne. She's executive director of the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jim, Chad Boss, I hope I pronounced his name right. He's the secretary of the Buckeye Firearms Association.
Yes.
Has said in the wake of the church shooting last month in South Carolina that gun bans in places of worship should end in states such as Ohio and South Carolina. Are there any places that should be restricted?
Absolutely. I think a courtroom is probably the easiest place to show. First of all, understand this is a basic constitutional right. So like the First Amendment, it should be broad, but every right can be restricted. The key is the state has to show good need. So the First Amendment, the common example is you can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater because you're risking other people's lives doing that. So everybody understands that's a good restriction. On the Second Amendment, we should have the same burden. The state has to show why there's a need to restrict a gun. In a church, what's the need? No one's ever even proposed how this is going to hurt somebody, and in fact, it doesn't. All places, people carry guns in churches. So, but where can you restrict a gun? A courtroom. Think about somebody who's on trial for rape of somebody's daughter, and he gets acquitted, and how upset the father is. Maybe they got the wrong guy. Maybe the guy is innocent. But to the father whose daughter has raped, it doesn't matter. He wants revenge. He wants justice.
Is there any other place besides a courtroom?
Sure. The secure side of an airport. I think everybody agrees everybody shouldn't be carrying guns. There's police stations and the secure side there. There's certain, I think, you know, mental health aspects. There's certain places where, you know what, there's too much at risk given either emotion or the person involved in a courtroom. You've got a very violent person, but we can't prejudice the jury on him. So the bailiff has a complicated job keeping a courtroom safe. Those are places citizens with a concealed handgun license, I think there's a compelling need to prohibit them from carrying a gun there.
Jennifer Thorne, thoughts about where guns should be restricted? Where do you draw the line in your organization, the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence?
So we have opposed concealed carry or hidden loaded weapons in public spaces since our inception, and believe that guns carried by civilians have no place in our public spaces. I think for some of the same reasons that Jim has mentioned about, the dangers that might take place in a courtroom. I think those can take place everywhere. And as I've mentioned, everyone that's carrying a gun is going to be a good guy with a gun right up until they're not a good guy with a gun anymore. We don't really know what people's intentions are going to be the entire amount of time that they have their concealed weapon on them.
Luke in Mount Sterling, you're on the air. You support gun control legislation?
I do. Support the Second Amendment fully. But example being, your guest just mentioned, you don't know when a good guy's gun is going to become a bad guy with a gun. My 7th grade science teacher, I knew him quite well for a student, and knew he was a very loving, kind man. But one day, out of the blue, he just committed the murder-suicide, killed his wife, and then killed himself. And you never would have saw it coming. So there needs to be, there needs to be a look into mental health, but how to do it without being too invasive, I guess, is going to be the difficult part.
Mm-hmm. $6 million question. Luke, thanks for that call. Adam in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Had a quick question for the two panelists. What do they think about concealed carry on college campuses? Does that constitute an open space if it's a private university, for example?
Jim Irvine?
University campuses, Utah allows it. I think Colorado, they fought vehemently against having it there. The state legislature passed it anyway, and crime on campus is reduced. Crime campus, first of all, most of the people on a college campus, most of the students are under 21, so they can't get a concealed handgun license anyway. But what about your staff? What about your people who are taking graduate classes or people who are working, attending class at night and stuff like that, or your upperclassmen who want to do this? Bottom line is campuses are high crime areas, and especially just like churches, we like to pretend it's not because we just look at the building, we just look at the campus. But when you go to the parking lots in churches and you go to the surrounding, even couple blocks on colleges, it's a very different story. And that's where your students are living and working and parking their cars and coming back and forth. University of Cincinnati, it sits borders on the Over the Rhine area, a very violent area. There's a lot of crime that goes on there. Where we have allowed students to carry concealed firearms on campus, we've seen positive results, not negative ones. So I think we need to look at the actual data that we have and see that, you know what, it works. It is a good idea. And at least allow this college, at least at the very least, allow colleges the same right your grade schools have. And that is to say, hey, yeah, we're going to authorize some people to carry firearms for the protection of our kids, because we don't want to advertise to the person who wants to do a mass killing, hey, this is a good place. We collected all the people in one place, disarmed them, they're easy to kill, come do it.
Jennifer Thorne?
So something that Jim has just mentioned is the fact that your local school district here in Ohio has the ability to secretly arm members of faculty or staff. And frankly, we think that's a horrible idea. It's really unconscionable that, you know, that there are teachers walking around with guns in schools, and you know, teachers, families and parents don't know about it. Secondly, I would say that campus carry is wrong for Ohio. It won't make people safer. And I think you would certainly see things like unintentional shootings increase. You know, if we did have that allowed. And, you know, a lot of times folks that are in support of campus carry will say, you know, this is a good way for women to protect themselves from things like sexual assault. And, you know, I just want to get out ahead of that and say crimes like sexual assault typically occur between people that know each other. It's not a guy hidden in the bushes that's going to jump out where you're going to be able to protect yourself with your gun. It's just really a horrible idea. We don't need to have, you know, young people in the presence of more guns and further normalize the presence of those weapons in our society.
Jim Irvine, you referred to the fact that people under 21 can't get concealed license carrying license anyway. What do you think about that? Somebody can go to war at the age of 18, they can vote at 18, but they can't get a concealed carry license until they're 21. Is that something the Buckeye Firearms Association would like to see changed?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think it's patently wrong that someone who's gone and fought and engaged in war for our country with fully automatic and what truly are assault weapons, even though we throw that around for all sorts of things that aren't, that they come back home and they've been told by their commanding officers, hey, be careful on break. We've got chatter that ISIS is looking to target military members and their family. And then we don't allow them a gun to defend their life on their own soil. I think that's wrong. And I think it should be addressed, but it's not a huge priority for us because there's so many, and that's not that it's not important to me, and I know people personally, it's a personal issue to me, but our function as an organization, we focus on the things that will do the most amount of good for the most amount of people. And I think there's not enough people for that to make a huge priority for us, but it's something, you know, it's the right thing to do. I think our soldiers have proven themselves. We let our law enforcement officers between ages of 18 and 21 buy handguns and carry them. Why can't a military member?
Jennifer Thorne, what about the idea of age? Does the age difference really make, I mean, kids get into guns if they really want to get into guns anyway?
So, again, we don't believe anyone should have a concealed carry license or be able to carry a hidden loaded weapon in public. No. I mean, if you're a civilian, sorry, if you're acting as a civilian, it's just not a good idea. We do not need to further normalize the presence of these dangerous weapons in our society.
Walker and Carol, you're on the air. Hi, Walker.
Hi. I have a question for the gun advocate, and that is in the Second Amendment, they mention well-regulated militias along with the right to carry arms. So how do you correlate the right to bear arms with the need for well-regulated militia? And if you have a well-regulated militia, wouldn't you have some control over the arms that are related to that?
Okay.
I always wonder why one part of the Second Amendment gets totally ignored,
okay,
while the other is held up as gospel, basically.
All right, Walker, thanks for that call. Jim Irvine?
The term regulated in the Second Amendment is referring to trained, not the regulation of. So it's a well-trained militia. It's important that people are trained. If you go back and look at the Founding Fathers' stuff in the original colonial days, people were exempted from certain duties if they were out training with firearms. It was to encourage people not to just possess the guns, but to use them, to be proficient with them, to be able to be skilled with them. That's what the regulated part of the Second Amendment is saying. And I think that's important. If we go back in our country 50, 60 years, shooting clubs in high schools were the common thing. Kids were familiar with firearms. They went hunting before school and after school. It wasn't this big mysterious thing that they had curiosity but no knowledge of how to do stuff safety
well,
with.
Jim Irvine, then, are you supportive? I mean, in some states, they're calling for abolishing even training requirements for weapons, for guns.
Well, I mean, look, you don't have to have training to go to church. You don't have training to be securing your persons. You don't have to have training or permission from the government to exercise any of our constitutional rights. Why the Second Amendment should be different than every other right, I'm not sure.
Well, because that a gun said, can kill somebody and church doesn't. I mean, isn't that patently obvious why?
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at our whether you look at our country or our world, religion has been used to justify incredibly harmful things. I mean, just how much killing goes on in the name of religion is a big deal. It's a massive multi-millions of people killed over religious issues. So I think it's a lot worse than the gun issue. It's being used as the excuse, not the tool.
But it's
still tied in.
We only have a few minutes left, Jim Irvine. I don't want to cut you off, but I got a lot of, I want to get through some emails real quick here. One from Joanne in Dublin. She said, I would treat gun ownership like owning a vehicle, which is not a deadly weapon. Issue titles and transfer titles when ownership changes, require insurance. Injuries with unlicensed weapons would be subject to charges and lawsuits. There should be taxes, too, so the state can be compensated for related crimes. An email from a listener in favor of gun control. I wish people would stop pinning blame on mental illness. The common denominator in these shootings has been rage, not mental illness. Adam Lanza was furious because his mother was going to move them to Washington State. The white retired cop in Colorado was furious that the man in front of him was texting in a movie theater. An email from Scott. For the 80-85% of the population that supports background checks, waiting periods, and other common sense gun regulation, it is never going to happen with Republicans controlling the Ohio General Assembly and governor's office. Voting matters. Jennifer Thorne, I just wondered what your goals are immediately with the Ohio General Assembly as it stands now. We only have about a minute left.
Sure. So currently there is a universal background check bill that has been introduced into the House. It's sitting and waiting in the House State Government Committee for a second hearing. And that's one of our most immediate goals. We would like to see something like a common sense bill, a universal background check bill, have its fair chance in the General Assembly.
And what about you, Jim Irvine? What are your immediate goals with the Ohio General Assembly as it stands?
We look at, I think overall, what we're always looking to do is reduce the number of innocent deaths. So that kind of covers everything. We want to see victim zones reduced, the places where people can't carry a gun, and allow the freedoms that people in other states have, enjoy those same freedoms for gun owners here in Ohio.
Okay. Well, Jim Irvine, thanks again for joining us today. We really appreciate your participation.
I think you do a great show, and I love the format. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, Jim. Jim Irvine, he's the chairman of the Buckeye Firearms Association. And Jennifer Thorne, thanks to you as well for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Jennifer Thorne, she's executive director of the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, All Sides interns Shahinas Sagiri, Ryan McFadden, Sam Buck, and Matt Berkeley, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. And you can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.
on the next Fresh Air. We'll talk about the Supreme Court marriage equality decision with Mary Bonato, one of the attorneys who argued before the Supreme Court and who helped devise the state-based strategy that led to the overturning of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. Also with us will be Evan Wolfson, one of the architects of the marriage equality movement. Join us.
Listen to Fresh Air today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Support comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club presenting their weekly forum. Wednesday at noon, it's a conversation with Loretta Mester, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. Hear about banking, the economy, and U.S. monetary policy. For information and tickets, visit columbusmetroclub.org. This is WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus, 89.7 NPR News. Global, local.
The contested divorce, that often ugly battle over property and money, is the stuff of television and movie plot lines galore. The War of the Roses, The First Wives Club, and Intolerable Cruelty come quickly to mind. But increasingly, real-life marriage breakups are managed with less celebrated versions of divorce, including the collaborative style, which incorporates specially trained lawyers versed in actually working together. Coming up, the collaborative divorce, how that looks and how it works. That's after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org.